Welcome to Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. George Orwell's famous dystopian novel 1984 is one of the most important books of the 20th century, still widely referenced today across politics and culture. In this episode, Dorian Lynskey and Adele Suliman discuss the book's huge legacy and what Orwell would think about the state of today's world. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this discussion feels more relevant than ever, with increasing surveillance, state-sponsored propaganda, and threats to free speech in the real world today.
Okay, welcome everybody. Thank you for your patience. We are here with Dorian Lynskey, and we are going to be discussing George Orwell's 1984. You need no introduction, but you are a freelance journalist, author, and host of the very brilliantly named podcast, Oh God, What Now? my name's Adila. I'm a journalist for the Washington Post, based in London. And yeah, we're going to chat quite casually for about 20 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions, because I know there's lots of people here with much more expertise than me on George Orwell. So yeah, let's kick straight off. So tell us about why George Orwell is so special to you. I mean, you've written a book about him. He's something that you've, you know, really researched. What about him is connected with you that you've chosen to do this?
Yeah, so I came to this through slightly indirectly, because I was really interested in dystopian fiction. And I think if you read a lot of it or you see the dystopian movies, and I'm always interested in where the sort of the tropes come from, that they're very familiar and you recognize certain things that people wear or say. And I just thought, well, what, you know, why is this the way that dystopias work? And then I realized that so much of it comes from 1984, that dystopian fiction existed before then, but it was quite messy and often not a particularly good read. It was very much ideas. There was a long tradition from the late 19th century where people would write about the world that they wanted to see or the world they really didn't want to see. But rather than having like a story and characters that were interesting, they would just have people sort of waking up in the future and then walking around and having things explained to them. So I've read a lot of these, and I would recommend almost none of them. But Orwell did, you know, Orwell read some of these, and he also put them together with other things that you might not think of as dystopias. He was interested, you know, Gulliver's Travels. There's a section in Gulliver's Travels which he felt was relevant. Even Macbeth, he thought, was like a sort of a version of a police state. It was almost a totalitarian police state once Macbeth has taken over. So through him, I realized that you could tell the story of dystopias before him and definitely after. And most dystopian fiction now at least is aware that 1984 exists. It's either imitating bits of it or sort of arguing with it. And then sort of having sort of done that bit, then you start reading everything he's written. And there's a complete works, which is 20 volumes, which I believe is 2 million words. And sort of when you're reading all of that, the good news is that he's like a good person to spend time with, even though he's kind of a, you know, he's cranky, he's got these blind spots, he's got these incredibly dismissive of things he should not have been dismissive of, you know, annoying sometimes. But there's a kind of attempt at working out the world, which I found really endearing, and a self-awareness and an honesty about what he's trying to understand and the obstacles, his own cognitive biases. And sometimes he's aware of his own blind spots. And I just felt like, oh, this is someone who's honestly trying to sort of understand the world and his place in it and his political project, which is really good because some people write biographies. This isn't a biography. It's partly a biography of him, more obviously a biography of the book. But some people write biographies of people who are like awful, just awful people to spend time with. I mean, there's a 3-volume biography of Hitler, and I just can't imagine what that experience would be like. Whereas with Orwell, I always felt like, oh, there's somebody quite good on my side here, you know, in my head. And there's just so many bits of his writing, not just the famous stuff, but even just throwaway, like movie reviews. And he was a very bad film critic. But there'd be these amazing lines. There was always something fascinating in his diaries, in his letters. And so it was like a two-part thing. Partly I'm spending time with Orwell, and then partly I'm trying to explain the history of dystopias and how people have how people have tried to kind of map out the worst society they can imagine.
Mm. I mean, you say that dystopia existed before him, and you talk about his writing. So what is it about him, the individual, the writer, what had happened in his life that makes him so enduring and so special and makes his words light up to the point where we're still discussing and studying them now?
Well, firstly, he's just a very good writer. You know, it's just an incredible talent for very sort of clear, emphatic, quite witty prose. I mean, weirdly, 1984 is the thing he's most famous for, and the least funny thing he ever wrote was, if you read his journalism, there's so much wit, there's also clarity, there's also the way that he puts himself in the writing, like his own opinions. He's kind of, you know, he's just a very... He's so persuasive that sometimes I'm reading something that he's arguing and I agree with it, and then I stop myself and go, actually, I don't agree with that. Like, I think he's wrong. But he's so kind of alluring in his writing. And then the other thing is the context. So 1984 is his attempt to explain totalitarianism and how it works, mainly in Stalin's Russia, but also in Hitler's Germany. It's just that by the time he'd written 1984, you know, Hitler was dead, the war was over, and whereas Stalin was still there. But he was interested in both of those societies and how they operated. And that became almost the most important question of the mid-20th century, you know, and beyond. It's like, well, how were these societies established? How did they exert power? Why did so many people go along with them? How were they able to cause so much damage? How can this be? How can we avoid this happening again? And at various periods since then, that has seemed more urgent. And I think right now, there's a lot of concern about, I mean, I say largely on the sort of radical right. There's not so much of the sort of Stalinist threat in the world. And people are seeing the same distortion of language, blatant disregard for the truth, the abuse of power. And so he found these sort of timeless concerns, and he was somebody who lived through the kind of like the epicenter of the 20th century. That he fought in the Spanish Civil War. He was in London during the Blitz. He did some reporting in Europe just towards the end of the Second World War. And he knew a lot of the, you know, he knew a lot of the most important intellectuals and politicians of the time. So I think there's that. It's there's the mixture of the timelessness and the way that he kind of represents his own time, a time which is sort of endlessly, fascinating/horrifying.
Mm. I mean, yeah, you're a writer. How important is it to have this personal experience of these things in order to put that on the page? Or do you think he kind of lived in his imagination too?
I think it was really important to him because, you know, his imagination was not great. Like, as novelists go, like, each of his novels, including, like, the early ones that aren't as widely read, they're all about things that he did. So he served in Burma as a sort of colonial policeman and then wrote this kind of Burmese Days, which is a sort of savage, guilt-ridden takedown of, you know, imperialism. And then he's like a struggling writer, so he writes Keep the Aspidistra Flying, which is about a struggling writer. And so virtually everything in... And if you think about it, Animal Farm, obviously...
It's quite imaginative.
The talking animals bit is imaginative, but everything that he's allegorizing is stuff that happened. Like, it's very historically accurate, if you know what he's referring to. And in 1984, everything is taken from somewhere. And so part of the project of the book and the real pleasure of the book, by reading all of his other work, because he was a working journalist more than a novelist, and the amount of work he was doing meant that he was a great recycler. And so you could find a line in a book review from 5 years earlier that appears in 1984. And so he was drawing all this stuff that he'd read about, you know, life in Germany and life in the Soviet Union, but also details from his own life. So the office scenes are all based on when he worked at the BBC. That doesn't mean that he thinks the BBC was this nightmarish regime, but that was his experience of offices. And the Prole district was his neighborhood in Canonbury, which is now very, very posh, but at the time was definitely not. And so that was almost what made it so pleasurable, that there are some novelists whose imaginations are so huge that the idea... So asking them, well, where do you get your ideas from? is they novelists hate that question, right? And they just, well, I just invent. Whereas with Orwell, you can literally trace where he got all of his ideas from, what he'd read, who he'd spoken to, what he'd experienced, where he'd worked. And that all feeds into that novel. And he felt that he had to experience something in order to write about it, which I think most people don't. That's not a necessity. But for him, he thought to have any authority, he had to know what it was like. He had to know what it was like to be sleeping on the streets for a bit. He had to know what it was like to have fought in Spain. And there were loads of people back in London writing about the Spanish Civil War. You know, I would probably have been one of them. You know what I mean? He had this kind of tendency to just hurl himself into these very difficult, life-threatening situations because he felt that's what gave him like the moral authority to talk about them.
To go that extra mile.
Write about them, yeah.
So interesting. So we're celebrating 75 years now of 1984. I think it was published in 1949, wasn't it? So, you know, he makes a lot of glib predictions. Do you think we've neared them, surpassed them? Do you think he hammed them up? Do you think...
Oh, I don't think... Yeah, that's why I disagree. I don't think he makes any predictions at all in 1984.
Okay, about the future or how things might be.
It's not predictions. It's saying basically what had already happened. That pretty much everything that happens in 1984, he had taken from what had already happened. So there's certain like innovations like the telescreen, to try and make it seem a little bit, futuristic. But no, he's not really predicting anything. What he's doing is he's going, this happened, over there, and this is what it might be like if it were to happen in Britain and by extension America, and in the kind of rough drafts, which are very incomplete, there's loads of missing pages, but there's a fair chunk of like the early versions, back when it was called 1980 and 1982. And then the longer it took him to finish the book, he just kept having to bump the year back.
So there's no real significance in 1984.
No, which really surprised me. I was like, oh, okay. I'm not sure it was called that, but it was set in 1980, and set in 1982, and finally in 1984. And there, in one of the early drafts, there's a lot more about what's going on in America as well. And his argument was that the worst mistake would be to assume that totalitarianism... Because back at the time, there were a lot of national stereotypes, and there was a sort of assumption, it's like, well, that's the Germans, and that's the Russians, or that's the Japanese, and because of their national character, they're particularly prone to, to totalitarianism. And he was going, no, you could have a British version, you could have an American version. You know, he wanted to bring it home. So his argument was that this is a warning, not a prophecy. But the reason it's so powerful is because it feels like a prophecy. And setting it, and this is a huge innovation, is that all the dystopias up to then would be set in the very distant future. I can't even remember when Brave New World is set, but it's like a very, very long time. People are talking like hundreds, thousands of years into the future. And he chose 35 years.
Why did he do that, do you think?
Which was far enough. I think one reason was that basically Winston was the same age as his son, his adopted son, Richard. So it was imagining basically the next generation, the world his son might grow up in if things went bad. But the kind of perfection of that is it's far enough away to sort of be credible. Like it's not like, because there would be other ones where it would be about a fascist takeover the day after tomorrow. And a lot of time people would think, well, it's probably not going to happen next week. 35 years away, it seemed that might happen, but it was close enough that a lot of his readers would have thought, I could live to see this. So it's this sort of sweet spot, which is incredibly powerful. And it's weird that he was sort of one of the first people to find that middle ground between next week and 1,000 years away.
Really scary. So let's talk about his impact on modern culture. I mean, we've got Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale, Big Brother show. We've got his impact on language, newspeak, and doublethink. I mean, how come it's so enduring 75 years on?
I mean, there's probably a few reasons. One is that he kind of, because he was also influenced by thrillers, spy thrillers, and detective fiction, and sort of film noir and stuff. So he brings quite a lot of genre stuff into the dystopian ideas. So it's not just people discussing political ideas as they walk around. it's genuinely dramatic. And if people, hopefully some people here have read 1984, I won't give anything away, but there are bits where it's genuinely really dramatic. It's really, so there are like secret meetings and twists and people you think are on your side who aren't on your side. Like, this is just good stuff. And therefore it can be read, unlike most of these books, by a 13-year-old. And they're not going to get everything. I certainly didn't when I read it then, but it's going to be exciting. So it's a good read, right? That's really important. And it sets up all these tropes that then influence all other kinds of things. So a lot of the time you recognize from a movie or a comic book or a young adult novel, and you sort of go, oh, right, okay. So Orwell was doing that, you know, back in 1949. So yeah, he's a really good writer. And then I think the language is a massive thing, because it's most novel. There are certain novels, right, where you get one famous phrase. So Catch-22, if you've never read Catch-22, you probably know the title phrase, but that's it. Whereas this has loads of them. It's got Big Brother, and it's got Doublethink, and Newspeak, and Memory Hole, and The Thought Police. And this language, almost immediately, as soon as the book came out, I went back to all these newspaper archives, and just seeing how quickly these words appeared in the press and in political speeches and House of Commons and so on. And it was almost immediate. I didn't always get it right. There's a wonderful guy in the House of Lords going, I wonder if anybody has read George Orwell's important novel, 1980. But, you know, you know what he meant. And so these things just sort of spread out starting in the 1950s. And now if you just go on Twitter, say, and you search any one of those words, you will find somebody using it. And because of that, and because even a lot of people have read the book, have not read his other work, or biographies, and don't really understand his politics, it's sort of something for everybody. So it's not a book that's just sort of popular with socialists or just popular with conservatives. It's sort of everybody thinks that they can, pretty much everybody thinks the book is on their side, except Stalinists, I think. Stalinists know that it's not, but everybody else wants to use it. So you can have a lot of Donald Trump's allies will use language from 1984, which from my point of view seems to be missing the point somewhat, and that maybe they're the bad guys. So there's that as well. There's that sort of amazing versatility, which is both great for sort of spreading its sort of fame and its influence, but there's also a downside to that, which is one motivation for writing the book, was I wanted to say what Orwell's politics were, what he was thinking, where these things were coming from. And that doesn't mean that people can't have their own interpretations of certain bits, because it is a book where you can bring your own ideas to it. But I thought it was important to at least say, well, this is where he was coming from. You know, it's really important. American conservatives couldn't believe that he was a supporter of the Labour Party, because they thought, surely this book is attacking the Labour Party. And he was absolutely horrified. He was like, no, it's attacking like Stalin. It's not. There's a big difference between Stalin and Clement Attlee. So I think it's really important to have all the information and the context to at least get what his intentions were. But yeah, it's almost through the misunderstandings is almost one of the reasons why it's so famous. If it was only enjoyed by people who agreed with him, it wouldn't be as big.
That's true. Yeah, I was going to say, I covered the Trump election, and we got alternative facts then. And I mean, we've had an election here yesterday. What do you think Orwell would make of our current modern political landscape?
Well, it's impossible to say, because the thing about Orwell is that he's always sort of reflecting what's changed. So if you have this experience of like reading everything, you can see him really constantly changing his mind. Like, his values are basically the same. He doesn't like swing from like left to right or whatever. But his assessments of situations are constantly changing. And so what he's saying in 1939 is not the same as 1940. And therefore, to sort of imagine what he would make of 2024, I didn't even know what he would have made of the Korean War. You know, which started a few months after he died. Maybe the month after. I mean, like, once you've read enough pieces of people going, Orwell would have supported the war in Vietnam. No, Orwell would have opposed the war in Vietnam. It just makes you very, very skeptical of what he would have thought. But what that taught me, actually, was that you should always adapt your sort of analysis and your ideas, but not your values, to the changes in the world, you know, that to kind of keep an eye on things and how things are evolving. And you can't apply the same sort of fixed dogma to everything that happens, because like history moves really fast and things change, and you might find yourself in one position then and another position later. So it's more like a way of thinking, which I found, and also acknowledging when you're wrong. He's really good at going, I was wrong and this is why I was wrong, which is a very rare quality. So that I find really inspiring. But I honestly, I mean, it's just become so hard. It's like, would you prefer Starmer or Corbett? I mean, probably Starmer, but I don't think he'd have been a big fan. He was very critical of everyone, basically.
Yeah. Maybe that's his enduring legacy.
It's just that everybody's letting you down, pretty much.
Trust no one. Okay, we're going to open it up now, I think, to questions. So there will be a roving mic around. You can just raise your hands if you're feeling confident.
Cheers. Thanks for that. What one of the phrases in, like, connected when you speak, which I think is a fantastic use of language in itself in the book, but connected with that, he uses the phrase duck speak, which I think, well, the question is, do you think that's a more accurate description of what kind of is going on social media and stuff?
Which word did you say?
Duck speak.
Oh, duck speak.
To mix me metaphors, where people parrot a phrase, and the idea is it's... Oh. Divorces the language completely from actually being able to think through the thought process behind it.
No, I get it. God, do you know, I'd forgotten about duck speak. That's really good. That's a really good question. Yeah, because that does reflect a lot of what he's writing elsewhere in journalism. He also talks about something called pamphletese. So it's the language people would use in political pamphlets. And he really hated these set phrases. And there were set phrases, didn't matter what your political inclination were, you would have your batch of phrases. And it stopped people from thinking very much. For example, like if you call Starmer Blairite, that actually stops you from thinking about the ways in which he is or is not like Blair and the ways that he's different. It stops you from sort of seeing things as they are, because you're just like, well, here's the category that I've already got. And it's made me unbelievably pedantic. Like Orwell's influence, like when people talk about a supermajority, were you aware of that over there? And a supermajority has no meaning in British politics. It's like an American concept, and people kept using it, and I kept getting angrier and angrier, and it's like, it's not a real thing. But as soon as somebody had mentioned it, everyone just started using it, like, oh, okay, right. And so there's that idea that you're talking about there, that there's a real habit that people have of just sort of learning a phrase, like a catchy phrase or a catchy word, and just applying it, and it can stop you thinking. You can almost just spiel out these set phrases. So I think that happens on social media all the time, and almost that's almost what it's designed to do. If you think how often you see certain memes, that's a way not to have to make a joke or a point. You just go, oh, here's this little gif that I've seen a million times, and I'm going to use that rather than do something original. And he puts such a premium on originality, which is hard. It takes more work, but I think it's a really good idea. And I think that what you're talking about, he prepared people to gramophones as well. He talked about the gramophone mind, which is the idea that basically everything that you were saying was basically just being played off a record player. And he hated that, not just because as a writer, he found it boring, but I think he also thought, well, that's taken to extremes. That's what fascism and Stalinism did. There were all those phrases in, say, Nazi propaganda that would just come over again and again and again. And we still, echoes of them now, when people talk about the will of the people or whatever, there are certain phrases and you're just thinking, what does that mean? Who are the people? Like, what is their will? Maybe we have different... I'm sure even in this room there are people who have different wills. But you're all the people. You know, so I think he thought, okay, these things are annoying, but they can also be very dangerous.
Good question. Any more? There's one at the very back there.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that Orwell's 1984 is arguably the most important book about politics written in the 20th century, but I'd be interested to know how you rate, or if you're aware of, Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle, in the sense that although it was written about 15 years later, what it's predicting is that we're not controlled by a party, a state machine, that we're controlled by screens. This is the spectacle that, rather than doing things, we just watch. And obviously, in his day, this was the beginning of television, advertising, hoardings, and so on. Today, obviously, it's the smartphone, isn't it? That we don't really need politicians and multi-billionaires, Elon Musk and all the rest of it, because our minds, particularly young people, it seems to me, are pretty much controlled by the smartphone. What do you think about comparing Debord with Orwell?
Okay. I mean, Debord doesn't come up in the book. I mean, I know the book you mean. There's a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman from the 80s, which came out of like a symposium on 1984. He's like on a panel. And his argument is like that America in the 80s and the West in the 80s was much more like Brave New World than 1984. And it wasn't, you know, people in jack boots knocking at your door. It was giving people what they want, numbing them with entertainment, kind of thing, which is in a similar kind of vein, you know, to what you're talking about. And the sort of conclusion I came to is it's a sort of like a bit of both. I mean, I don't think of people being controlled by smartphones or controlled by advertising or PR or whatever. But I do think that, I think what's quite scary is that you see people sort of self-radicalizing online. And there are a lot of conspiracy theories. They might have somebody like Trump pushing them, or Robert F. Kennedy Jr., or they might not. A lot of conspiracy theories are just kind of, they're grassroots, and they're just sort of being passed around. So I think, without being a sort of cynical of mass media as Debord was, I do think there is something like you don't need a regime to make you believe things that aren't true. You can do that by yourself. And that I find really troubling, where there's a lot of people, particularly where I see them generally online, you know, who believe things that are just wildly untrue, and they've created a narrative, and nobody sort of made them do that. They've just, you know, maybe they got lost on YouTube or whatever. And so that's maybe something that Orwell would, although he was really grumpy about advertising as well. But that's something that perhaps you don't get so much in the novel, of people doing it to themselves. And that, I think, is the real, that can be a really concerning thing. It's the way people's psychological biases go. And I think people's own psychological biases are far more powerful than any marketing or screen or advertising.
The turnout being so low, I mean, Labour seemingly got less votes this time than Corbyn did. In other words, more and more people are thinking, oh, I'm not interested in politics, they're all the same, and so on, and go back to just flicking through, I don't know, TikTok or whatever it is.
I wouldn't blame the screens for a lack of turnout, though.
What I'm saying is that the people are just so preoccupied. You go to a coffee bar or whatever, and you see young people, and they're actually all on the phone. They're not having a discussion at all. And what I'm saying is that you've got this thing, this little reified thing in your hand that's your world. And what goes on out there in politics or beggars on the street or whatever, oh, well, that's just nothing to me. I'm just interested in my TikTok or my WhatsApp or whatever. It just seems to me we've got a generation that's their view of the world. And that politics, well, that's just nothing to do with me. Let them get on with it.
I mean, yeah, I'm not sure I would share that critique, but I mean, it's fair enough. But I think if you look back, people saying stuff like that about TV, not just in the 1980s, but in the 1950s, and there's always a sense that you know, screens are going to sort of degrade the political process, and maybe for some people, like you're saying, your real concern is distraction, right, and therefore disengagement. I suppose what I'm more concerned about is people who aren't who are very engaged, but in stuff that is simply untrue and quite corrosive, like that. The explosion of conspiracy theories online bothers me more than someone who's just sort of tuned out and on TikTok, because I don't think that that person would otherwise be deeply engaged in a general election. I think there have always been people who are just sort of tuned out, but the way that they do it is the way in which they distract themselves changes over time. I mean, I think you made a fair point, but that would probably be my take.
Interesting. Okay, let's take one from this side. There's a gentleman on the right. And then...
Yeah, I was interested when you said the difference. American conservative were aghast when they found that Orwell was kind quite progressive and, you know, a supporter of the Labour Party, as it were. Do you see his life... Two questions. Do you see his life as a bit of a guilt trip, that he was eaten, well-heeled, colonial background, Burmese police... You know, was there a dramatic change in his attitude that you can define in a particular period?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one. And the second one is something slightly baffled me. He worked for the Ministry of Information during the war. Now, the Ministry of Information was the, in a way, kind of the derivation of the Ministry of Truth, and was involved in propaganda.
Okay. Do you,
right, now, I'm very specific about one thing as well. I'm chair of the J.B. Priestley Society, which is based in Bradford, but nationwide. He made a list of fellow travellers and put J.B. Priestley on it. Now, that seems to me not to be able to see the difference between Stalin and Clement Attlee. You know, J.B. Priestley was never a fellow traveller. You could never box him. Yeah, he had a social conscience and progressive and was quite left-wing in many ways, but never an overtly socialist and never joined the Labour Party. So two contradictions there.
Okay, all right. The guilt thing, I think, is really obvious. After Burma, around the time of Down and Out in Paris and London, and he was always kind of like, he didn't really fit in. He was a scholarship boy at Eton, so that gives you a real kind of like, a resentment that you're in the world of privilege, but you don't quite belong, and everybody else is wealthier than you, and they're looking down on you. Now, actually, a lot of his school friends went, there were quite a few scholarship boys, and the richer kids were not looking down on them. And so a lot of it was his own sort of quite powerful sense of self-loathing. But having had that privilege, then, for reasons I can't quite understand, to do with family or just wanting to get out there into the world, he went to Burma, and there was just huge guilt there, and people... contemporaries say he was attempting to purge himself. So then he just threw himself into, you know, poverty, essentially. You know, dishwashing in Paris and hot picking in Kent, and sometimes being on the streets and getting very, very ill. And there was a real sense of, like, trying to kind of scrub himself clean from this stigma. Because when he went to Burma, I don't think he was particularly political. And I think what he saw there made him very anti-imperialist and made him revolted. So that's the big period of guilt. I don't know whether that's a great motivator later on. But that's certainly the way that he moves towards socialism over like a decade. On the other one, he didn't work for the Ministry of Information. Like, he worked for the BBC, and it was a soft propaganda. It was basically arts programs. The idea was that they broadcast them to India to show that Britain was great because it had, you know, Shakespeare and Swift and poetry chat. So it was a form of propaganda, but not like the hard end of things. So he didn't work in the Ministry of Information. He did, with that list, very briefly, it's a bit complicated, but he had a friend / someone he had a crush on who worked at the Information Research Department, and their thing at the beginning of the Cold War was, again, kind of soft propaganda, like stuff that you couldn't tell was propaganda, was basically trying to promote Western values versus Soviet communism. And he gave her a list of people who he thought, she was like, which writers should I hire for this project? And he made a list of people he thought that she shouldn't hire. So that's what that was. And I don't know whether, and he took some of them from this list in his notebook, and I don't know whether Priestley was on both of those lists or not. So it was, it was for a specific purpose as opposed to a blacklist. So you understand why, it seems a bit like, really? Given what a sort of libertarian he was. But having kind of looked into it in detail, I didn't think it was like a terrible thing to do if you felt that Stalinism was a real enemy. But obviously Priestley wasn't a Stalinist. So I think his list should have been a lot shorter, I would say. And I think there were people on there that he probably just had personal grievances against because he was quite petty. And the list in his notebook is horribly petty. It's just, that was trimmed down a lot. But there were loads of people where it was just like, he just didn't like them. Don't use this person because...
Sounds like a classic writer.
Just like, well, they're annoying. It's like his burn book. But then the list that he gave to the IRD was much kind of more justifiable. Not his greatest moment, I'd say. I agree.
Thank you. I'll take a slightly different turn. I'm thinking again of human psychology and politics, again, perhaps inevitable because of the being close to a general election. I'm also thinking of totalitarianism in general. And of course, dear Damon, you've flagged up conspiracy theories, and of course, quite a lot has been written. I'm just wondering whether you think, A, it will be useful, or B, maybe an unhelpful diversion to understand more about how human beings respond to the sort of, I suppose you might call, key tropes of conspiratorialism. I don't necessarily just mean Donald Trump, but I mean how people react and then are turned on to what we might call the precursors of totalitarianism. Or do you think the whole issue is far too complex on a social level that we'd be frankly wasting our time? And by default, do you think there's anything we can do to counter it, even if we do have this greater understanding?
Well, the countering bit is difficult. I mean, there are things that there are a lot of people working on this and a lot of, correspondence on disinformation. But the psychology is absolutely vital. Like, why do people believe conspiracy theories? What's really interesting in Orwell's work is you can see him touching on things that hadn't been identified yet, cognitive biases. So particularly in something like Notes on Nationalism, and he observes certain ways of like tribal thinking. That you will believe the worst of your enemies and refuse to believe anything bad about the people on your side. Like, that seems like quite a simple thing. And in the decades since, psychologists have kind of given names to a lot of these biases and sort of fleshed them out. But Orwell was already noticing, like, why is it that people deceive themselves? Hence, doublethink, the novel. Like, how is it that, what is going on in the brain? And that's what you have to understand with conspiracy theories and all kinds of things in politics, political developments that might seem worrying. It's like, well, why? What need is being met by this belief? So you have to analyze it. And if you're worried about, say, the far right, you have to sort of think, well, what is it that is driving people in that direction? And really find out, and not just apply your own assumption. Because you might just go, well, they're all racist, and that's the only explanation. Or you might go, well, they're not, but they're all economically frustrated. And if only we dealt with the economic problems, then that desire would go away, right? And those are all quite simple explanations which perhaps reveal a certain political bias. But finding out what's really going on, which is actually a mix of different psychologies, is really important. And one thing I love about 1984 is that every character in that novel responds to life on Airstrip 1 in a different way. There's fanatics, and then there's cowards, and then there's cynics, and there's rebels, and they're all different. There wasn't one way that people behaved in Russia or Nazi Germany, and it's the same now. So I think understanding the psychology, the real psychological motivations of people, is absolutely fundamental.
Okay, I think we've got our last question here.
This is going to be a double question, really. Okay. We read Animal Farm in the 1960s at school. Are either Animal Farm and 1984 done at school now? But the second part of my question is, when you were talking about that it's not a futuristic book, that it was you know, Stalinism was making him write this. I wonder now with the coming in of AI and sort of the future thought about it actually makes it a possible futuristic book, if you know what I mean, a different sort of slant on it because of fears of what AI might do.
Yeah, it was the first one, yes, they still do Animal Farm. They still do, because my daughters did Animal Farm for GCSE and stuff. And I said, do you know, I have a book with a good chapter on Animal Farm that you can read. And she stubbornly refused to read it because it's me. But yes, and 1984 is quite common in sixth form because I do some talks at school. So yes, they're very much sort of alive and well. I mean, that's the futuristic thing. I mean, it is futurist. What's sort of amazing about it is that he identifies all of these, again, it's about psychology most of all. He identifies all these things that were happening. And a lot of the time he would draw these historical analogies and go, well, there are aspects of Stalinism which are entirely new, or Nazism. It's the age of the radio and the you know, aeroplane and it's, you know, technology changes. But then he would go, well, in which ways is this the same or different from dictators of the past? And so that's the timeless thing. And that was why any new thing that comes along, because he didn't have a TV. I don't know if he'd ever seen a TV when he wrote that, because they were so rare in Britain at that time. But he did think to put the telescreen in there, and then that becomes, then the television becomes more popular, and people go, oh, it's very Orwellian. There's an amazing article, American article, about TVs being introduced in East Germany. And they went, well, we don't have the two-way telescreen yet, but we do have the one-way telescreen. And it's like a television then. But because it was in East Germany, it was a sinister television. So each new thing that comes along, and some people might know the Apple, when the Apple Mac was launched, there was a very famous ad called 1984. And it was all about, you know, smashing the tyranny of the big computers, IBM computers, with the plucky Apple, which I don't think you could pull now.
No.
but again, then it was, and all the talk, again, searching newspaper archives, all the talk was then about computers. Anything involving like cameras, computers, advertising, it was like, oh, it's like Orwell. And you keep on going, and you keep on going, and you keep on going, and then the social media comes along, and you go, well, this is quite Orwellian. And then you're right about AI. And there are Orwellian aspects to that. And almost like an extreme version of the duck speak you were talking about, these people who use fixed phrases. And with AI, you don't need any imagination at all. You can just type in a thing. And all it does is scour stuff from somewhere else. So it's this kind of just lumpy digest. And there's not an original thought in it. It's like an approximation of art or creativity. So that's why it holds up when there's some really good dystopian novels, but they're so, or indeed like anti-totalitarian novels, but they're so of their time. And you think, well, if you want to learn about the 1940s, this is great, but what does it say now? And Orwell was interested in so many things, and the book is so complex, it's got so many ideas packed into it, that whatever happens in the world, politically or technologically, there's always a time when you can go, oh, it's like 1984. Like, that's what I find kind of quite miraculous about it, that it never... After the year 1984, a lot of people were going, well, now that the year has come and Orwell has been proved wrong, I guess people aren't going to read this book anymore. And obviously, that's not what happened. So it just keeps renewing itself. I don't see a time when it would not feel weirdly relevant to whatever you're worried about. It's basically the book that is always about whatever is bothering you at a particular point in history.
It's a good place to end, I think, the endurance of Orwell. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you to everyone for coming. And are you going to be signing books outside?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, so you can catch Dorian outside. Thank you very much.
Sorry for being a bit late.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.